tonight on Arena. We celebrate a Strauss's Fledermaus on the eve of its national tour and explore Icelandic Gothic in The Damned. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena, or you can watch live on rte.ie/arena. The Damned is a new film with an Irish-Icelandic connection. The story of a fishing community in the 19th century is inspired by the West Fjords of Iceland. It's a desolate, unforgiving, almost unlivable setting, yet one that is steeped in immense beauty and a turbulent folklore. In The Damned, it has been a very harsh winter. The small fishing crew in the employ of the owner of the fishing outpost, a widow named Eva, are so hungry they are forced to eat their fishing bait for survival. The Damned stars Odessa Young, Joe Cole and Siobhan Finneran. Directed by Thordor Pálsson of the Valhalla Murders fame, the film is written by Irishman Jamie Hannigan, and I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Jamie. But to get an idea of the film, hear the fisherman and the boat owner Eva, played by Odessa Young, themselves barely surviving a harsh and hungry winter, see a horrible vision out from the shore, a sinking ship caught on the jagged rocks called the Teeth. The question is, what are they going to do?
Poor bastards. They must have got stuck on the Teeth when the tide turned. What the hell were they doing this far north? Almighty God, protect these men and give them the help that they need. Save them from the perilous sea. Amen.
Hey, where the hell are you going?
Wait to get the bonfires lit. Anyone still alive out there will be freezing by the time we get them back to shore.
That is not our business.
It could be us out there.
But it isn't! And if they had any sense worth a damn, they wouldn't have taken a ship that big so close to shore in the first place. We lost Master Magnus out in those rocks. And you'd still have us take the bull out there. Let's go on next. For strangers? Foreigners.
We're not going to help them.
You heard what Miss Eva said last night, didn't you? We can barely feed ourselves. There might be 10, 20 people still aboard.
You don't like how I run things? Go and find another boat to work on. I'm the helmsman, dammit. It's my decision.
No, it's not. It's us. She owns the boat, not you.
There we hear the Icelandic fishermen fighting over what to do about this ship that they see sinking in the, on the horizon. Rory McCann as Ragnar, Joe Cole was Daniel, and Odessa Young as Eva from The Damned. And I'm delighted to be talking to its writer, Jamie Hannigan. Jamie, you're very welcome on Arena.
Thank you very much, Kate. Very happy to be here.
Now, Jamie, you're no stranger to strange worlds, given your work on Ruth Wilson's series The Woman in the Wall and the 2017 film Pilgrimage. The story of The Damned is based on an idea by the director, Thordor Pálsson. When were you approached to write the screenplay and what kind of brief did you get?
Well, it was very early on. They had a premise. I think Thor had been snowed in when he was in Ísafjörður one winter, and he had this basic idea. And I was recommended to himself and his producers, Emily and Camilla, by the executive producer on Pilgrimage for doing, I guess, historical stuff. And I met them. I really liked the premise. I thought I had a huge amount of potential. And I've been wanting to write some kind of little ghost story thing, especially something wintry set. I've been trying to get the rights to do a Michelle Paver book called Dark Matter, but it sort of couldn't get it. So this just seemed very head and scent at the time.
Now, your producers, Emily, as you said, and Camilla, says that they could find nobody like you who could create these worlds. How did you go about building this isolated world, this fishing community, which is isolated within Iceland itself?
I tend to do in all the work I do is a lot of research. I try to stick as much to first-hand reports. With pilgrimage, that was very difficult because it was, you know, medieval before there wasn't a lot of written records. With the damned mid-19th century Iceland, it was a lot easier. There wasn't that much translated English. I did a real lot of reading about isolated communities, records. There was a book about St. Kilda that I found quite useful, just about how people survive in these very isolated areas. When they're cut off for winter and they've only really had themselves to rely on.
So what can you tell us? I played a clip there, but what can you tell us about that central dilemma that the fishing community face? Is it based on a true story, or is it completely from your imagination and the director's imagination?
I think it was, at the time it was completely original in Thor's head. Now, there actually was a famous incident which he didn't recall until about 6 months before shooting. And one of the production team mentioned there'd been in the Middle Ages, there'd been a Basque fishing boat had actually sank, or it had gotten run aground on the coast of Iceland. And they had basically been starving and looking for food, and they'd raided some food from some farmers, and then the Icelandic locals rose up and murdered them all. And I had never heard of this. And then while we were just, as I said, a few months away from shooting, one of the production teams said, oh, presumably you're basing it on this. And we're like, I've never heard of this before. But no. And maybe Thor, I think, had read the story when he was in school or something, and it stuck in there. But as far as I know, no. I mean, when we met, it was actually, this shows how far back this goes, was about only maybe 2 weeks after Brexit in London. And we were all meeting there, an Irishman and Thor's from Iceland, Camilla's Norwegian, Emily's French. And we were all meeting in London, this place, you know, in England, which had suddenly decided that they didn't want to be a part of the world. It was a strange, strange feeling. But that sort of dilemma of whether or not to help people when you're not, you know, it's going to risk your own well-being, I think, is sadly just a very topical and remains so moral dilemma too.
So, Jamie, just describe what kind of a fix they're in when this further imminent disaster they see out with the sinking ship. They're in a pretty bad situation themselves. This is a very healthy, normally fishing village where people can make enough money from fish to keep them going for the year, but they're having a very bad year.
Yeah. Traditionally in Iceland, the fishing was, up until the late 19th century, was only done in the winter because that was the only way you could preserve the fish, was using the cold. And once they brought salt in, they could do it all year round. But in this particular case, yes, you would have enough to, it was something you could make a lot of money off if you were a boat owner. And in this case, the fish has been so bad that they've been reduced to eating the bait, which they would use for the fish, which sort of goes to show like quite how desperate things are.
Now, we want to talk about superstition, because superstition plays a great role when we're getting to the horror elements of the film. So maybe we'll play another clip. This is Helga, played by Siobhan Finneran. She's the cook, but she also has great knowledge and belief in superstition around the sea and around fishing communities. And in this clip, Eva, who runs the fishing business, she consults Helga because she's found a little stave, I think you call it, which is a little bundle of twigs and wood and feathers and stuff, and she wants to know what it is.
Found this hidden above the door.
Weren't hidden, miss. Wouldn't do no good if it were hidden. The Droga needs to see it.
What is it?
Wood from that ship.
What?
It's a stave, miss, to protect the house from evil.
Helga, the men cannot be reminded of what happened that night. I cannot afford to have them distracted by spirits and ghosts.
Not a spirit, miss. Not the way you're thinking. Most of it's skin and bone and blood, just like us. Only there's no life left in it anymore. Just hate. I've seen it in my dreams. It stays hidden during the day, miss. But at night, that's when I've felt it. Trying to get in here. Maybe you felt it too.
A clip there from The Damned, and I'm talking to its writer, Jamie Hannigan. So the people who, the fishermen, and what they do to this ship, this Italian ship that's in such danger, causes them huge, they were fearful of the ship, but they're also now consumed by guilt by whatever they do. And then superstition plays a huge role. It's a place, because it's so isolated, it's so atmospheric, that superstition has always been a huge thing in their lives. And this Dragoor, if I'm pronouncing it right, is the kind of manifestation of that superstition.
Yes, yeah. The Dragoor, I was, the guys that we, the idea was there was just going to be some sort of dark force that was menacing them once Eva, the person who owned the fishing station, had made this decision. And the I was given a lot of books, and I was reading through a lot of books on Icelandic literature, and very quickly the Draugr came up as this the thing that could basically be the work as the protagonist. So it's the ambiguity within the movie is very much intentional to keep that going. I kind of prefer that sort of slow burn creepiness rather than a lot of gore that. I'm not really a horror fan. I like ghost stories, but I'm not a huge horror fan.
It is hard to call it a horror film. Like, it is more suspense and superstition. There's none of those jump frights.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few put in. There was a, like, of the movies we were sort of referencing, or that was like an influence when I was starting writing it and talking to Thor and Emily and Camilla throughout, were films like John Carpenter's The Thing, obviously. There was also a Korean movie called Memories of Murder, specifically a scene in it where this woman's walking home at night through past a field, and there's a figure in the background, and it just sort of pops up from these crops. And then as she looks over, it's already popped down again. And there was something about this. It's a very eerie scene, and that sort of thing we wanted to kind of carry through the film. Just working, because Iceland, when I travel there, we did a research trip years ago, and there's something about being there and say it in winter, is the light just plays tricks on your eyes all the time. It's like this almost permanent dusk, and it is very easy to sort of imagine things in shadows or in that sort of half light, half darkness that is difficult to make out, and you have to sort of like blink and look over twice. That happened several times in the research trip. And it was just sort of slightly unnerving, even though we're all like just like going on a little road trip around Iceland.
Yes, and I think it's fair to say that terrible things start to happen. And are these terrible things happening out of accident? Is there somebody out to get them? Or is it their own guilt turning on themselves and eating them up?
Yes, yeah, that's all completely intentional was the idea. We wanted to maintain that idea of whether it was a supernatural force, but also it's...
I think we might have lost Jamie there for a second. We'll just see if we have him.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh,
I'm here.
Sorry, Jamie. I just couldn't hear you.
I beg your pardon.
Second.
Sorry, I'm hearing the engineer's room at the moment.
Oh, right. Okay. Sorry about that. No. Now, just to go back to the writing, you didn't only write the script, you also wrote the music or the songs.
Well, I did wrote, yes, the sea shanties throughout. I wrote, it was originally going to be it was originally going to be like, I was looking up Icelandic old sea shanties and things of what I could find, then it was going to set them to music. But just not shortly before filming, well, a couple of months, the director Thor asked, could I come up with songs come up with songs for them to sing that were purely original? I think he was trying to keep it more like a fable, like not link it directly to Iceland. So I was sort of trying to write songs in that feel. I've never written songs before, so I was just sort of coming up with lyrics and rhyming lyrics and then singing them to myself, recording them, and then I ended up sending them to the cast to learn.
All right, okay. And that wasn't, you didn't say, hey, I've written you the script. There's no need to ask me to do the songs as well.
It was a surprise, but I was like, oh, okay. I mean, Stephen McKeown, who did the music, did a lovely job. But I actually did worked with him. He did the music for Pilgrimage, the other film I wrote. It was a strange little reunion.
To get back to that meeting you had in London with your Norwegian and Icelandic partners in London, there is that theme that the ship that comes, that they have the question over whether they will save it or not. That is a foreign ship. And of course, they make a decision about it's more important to save themselves than, and one of the reasons for not saving the ship is that it's a foreign ship. So obviously that has resonance for today.
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah. Like I said, that doesn't, this day and age, sadly, it has become sadly more and more relevant every year, just with like seeing what's happening around the world.
Well, Jamie, congratulations on your film, The Damned. The Damned is currently in Irish cinemas. And Jamie Hannigan, thank you very much. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. Marriage, money and class are under the microscope in Die Fledermaus or The Bat or even The Revenge of the Bat. It is Johann Strauss's most popular stage work, a comic operetta of mistaken identity in which man about town, Eisenstein, and his wife Rosalinda and their maid Adele all find themselves at Count Orlovsky's mass ball in Vienna. Eisenstein doesn't know it yet, but he is walking into a carefully laid trap. Mezzo-soprano Sharon Carty plays Count Orlovsky and Richard Pearson conducts a new production for Irish National Opera, which begins a 10-venue national tour starting with Chimsatira in Tralee on the 1st of February. I'm delighted they're both in studio. Isn't it fantastic? A 10-stage tour all around the country.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We're getting everywhere.
Yes, and as you say, it's a light operetta, and it's in English.
And it's in English, yes. So the original would be in German. It's a Viennese operetta, but we're using an English National Opera English translation.
That's right.
So, yeah. And there's dialogue as well. So you get music and theatre all mixed in.
And you're playing a man.
I'm playing a man. So we were just talking about this earlier. The role in the score is a trouser role, so a mezzo-soprano generally. It is, Richard was informing me that sometimes it's also sung by a countertenor or a tenor. It's a male character, but in our production we're being a little bit gender fluid, the Count Orlovsky is a persona played by another kind of a cabaret nightclub owner character. Oh. So yeah, so there's a little bit of
ambiguity, a little bit of
meta mask. I'm not like physically masked, but I have, there's layers to the character of this production as well, so it's great.
Yes, Richard, because the setting is different as well, isn't it? It's not it's a more contemporary setting.
A little more contemporary, isn't it? Yes. I think 1920s.
Yeah, thereabouts.
So rather than the 19th century, but yeah, it's a beautiful design, incidentally.
Yeah, the costumes are gorgeous. And the costumes are really fab.
Yes.
So they're all off to your party.
Yes.
And are you up to badness or goodness in relation to Eisenstein and Rosalinda and Adele?
Yeah, I think my character has a certain disdain for the upper classes, and it's kind of that he is in with them, but maybe has a bit of disdain for the privilege, I suppose, that comes with wealth. So he hosts this party and is privy. The entertainment, which is the plot to embarrass Eisenstein, is he sees it as being for his entertainment, that he really wants to, you know, have a bit of a laugh at someone, and is looking forward to this party being the vehicle for that.
Okay, so we should listen to some of the music, because the music is very well known.
Yes.
Yes.
So this is from Act One. It's called So muss allein ich bleiben. So I must stay alone. Yeah, do you want to set that up for us, or will we just play it?
I'll just play it, yeah. I think.
Yeah, and this is Terry Takanawa singing.
Thank you.
There we have Eisenstein coming in there, and Kerry Takanawa was singing the Rosalinda part. So Eisenstein there has been a bit of a snake in the grass, isn't he? He's pretending he's going off to prison, but in fact...
Well, indeed. But the wonderful thing about the trio that you've just played the beginning of is that all three characters involved in this trio have been invited to this party. So the three characters being Eisenstein, his wife Rosalinda, and their maid Adele have all separately been invited to the party by Dr. Falker, who's
master, I guess.
Exactly, this elaborate plot, and so all these three characters know they're about to go to this wonderful party, but they have to pretend that they're sad for various other reasons. That Adele has, you know, has said that she wants the evening off because her aunt is very ill, and Eisenstein has got to pretend that he's going to prison.
All right, so they're all at it.
They're all at it, yeah. Yes. They're all pretending to be sad. And
there's another character who wants to woo Rosalinda, who ends up getting sent off to jail.
Alfred,
because,
yes.
Because, yeah, he agrees to pretend to be Eisenstein to go off to jail. So he kind of gets landed in it as well quite a bit.
So it's a wonderfully elaborate plot.
Now, Richard, the wonderful thing about this 10-venue tour is that you're going to be there, and as conductor, you have an orchestra.
I do.
So people have live music as well as wonderful live opera. So what is your orchestra?
Well, of course, it was originally written for a full symphony orchestra, so 60, 70 players possibly. But for these venues... I've arranged it for a chamber orchestra with me at the piano plus eight other players. And we're going to be on the stage in costume, part of the action.
With interaction.
With interaction.
I get to pull him around a bit, which is great fun. you never get to actually go.
So in all these venues, there's going to be a packed stage with lots of action,
exactly.
Lovely costumes.
Yes.
Yep.
Now, let's listen to another piece of music. This is Act 3, and this is The Laughing Song. Could you tell us about that?
I think it's actually in Act 2, The Laughing Song.
It is, yes. There are two legs here, not one. Yeah, The Laughing Song.
This is at Orlovsky's party. So now at the party are the maid Adele, dressed up as a fine lady in one of her mistress Rosalinda's dresses. Eisenstein is there, and
he can't believe his eyes. Sure, he can't.
Sorry,
he can't believe his eyes.
He can't believe. He suddenly sees
because he's wondering what's the maid
and
there.
And he says to someone, "That looks just like my maid. What's she doing here? In one of my wife's dresses as well." And Adele pretends to be shocked that anyone could think that she is a maid, and shames Eisenstein for treating her this way, and. Said,
it's quite something when you think about it, really.
Yes.
She's
having a wonderful time pretending to be this fine lady and humiliating her master.
With this laughing song.
Saying, you thought I was a maid, and gets everyone to laugh at him.
Yeah. And it's wonderful musically as well that they have the laughing is kind of built into her vocal part as well. It's wonderful.
Fantastic. Let's listen to that.
Come, Misha, if they thought.
That's Edita Gorbarova there singing the laughing song for Die Fledermaus, and I'm with Sharon Carty and Richard Pearson, the conductor and the mezzo-soprano of this Irish National Opera Tour. The orchestra there was the Viennese, Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra with André Previn. Now, you'll be even busier than André Previn because you're not only conducting the orchestra, you're conducting the singers. And yes. you're also playing the piano.
Also playing the piano, yes.
Oh, right, okay. That's a lot you've taken
Man
on.
Of many talents.
It's going to be a challenge, yes.
He's doing it wonderfully.
I mean, I can only say it's wonderful to be working with such a wonderful cast of singers.
It's great fun in the rehearsal room.
Yes,
it's a really good atmosphere.
Yeah.
And you have worked with the INO before.
I have, yes, a couple of times. Hansel and Gretel, a lovely production, which was a co-production with Theatre Lovett, I believe, just before COVID, which went on a similar tour that we're doing. And on the Werther that INO did, I just played the piano for rehearsals for that and rescored that for a chamber orchestra. So, yes, I've worked for...
And you, Sharon?
A couple of times.
Yes, since its inception, actually. So it's really wonderful to be back in another production.
Yes, and it's so wonderful that they do both touring operas. That we were talking to them recently about one they're doing in conjunction with a company in America. So it's again a pared-down opera.
Yeah, we were just talking about this in the car on the way over, that how there's just such a wide range of... types of collaborations and venues and scale of, you know, composers and eras and collaborations with, you know, theatre and film and dance, that it's just such a really innovative company to be a part of.
Now, you're touring Die Fledermaus, as we say, to the 10 venues, and one of those 10 venues is Sligo.
Yes.
And you have a deep connection with Sligo.
I have a deep connection. I have family connections. Most of my ancestors are from there, but I've also recently become the artistic director of the very wonderful Sligo Baroque Music Festival. And we're really excited about a young person's project that we have, a youth opera, which is we're starting to recruit for right now. So if any teenagers in the Northwest might be interested in coming on board with us, they can get their parents or guardians to have a look at the Sligo Baroque Music website.
Right. And what would it involve for a young person?
It's going to be really exciting. We've got a wonderful Galway composer, Anna Malarkey, is going to work with the kids on composition. A Cork poet, Molly Toomey, is going to talk them through or work with them to help them to develop the story.
Both two people we've had on Arena.
Yeah, and they're
yes.
both just mm-hmm. brilliant girls. They're just so incredible, such wonderful artists and such really lovely human beings as well. So it'll be a really positive experience for the kids. We've got James Reardon, I think he's also from Galway, but he's involved in Machnus to do movement and stagecraft with them. Fantastic German opera director is coming over. She's worked with the Salzburg kids opera projects as well. She's going to work with them on directing. A lovely person called Sue Crawford, who is going to do props. And then fantastic Claire Garvey is going to work on costumes sustainably with them. And then myself will do singing.
Right. And where do they get the information for that, Sharon?
Sligo Baroque Music Festival website. So if they just Google Sligo Baroque Music Festival, they'll find it.
Now, Richard, what is it like what are the logistics of bringing a show like this on tour?
Oh, there's huge logistics with this. I mean, from the set itself, which of course has to be dismantled and transported and then reassembled in every theatre, plus the piano. There's many.
You're bringing the piano with you.
To some venues, and some venues will have their mm-hmm. own piano that we can use. And there's of course all the costumes, and there are many costumes. They're simply wonderful costumes,
yeah.
aren't they?
They're seen beautiful. Them. Yeah, like.
Mm-hmm.
So will there be trucks and trains or trucks and cars?
All on trucks, I think.
Yeah, trucks. I think yes. So. There'll be a busy backstage team doing the get yes. in and the get out before and after every show.
And there's quite a variety of size of theatre, and some of the smaller ones be quite a challenge. I think the set has been designed, of course, with the smallest theatre in mind so that they fit into all of them. But
So let's finish now with the Champagne Song. And this is what your Count Arlovsky performs.
This is a toast to Champagne, the Emperor of Wine. So we're bowing down before royalty that is Champagne and just singing about how wonderful it is.
That was the Champagne song from Die Fledermaus. Bridget Fassbender, Ida Gruberova and Wolfgang Brindel there singing. And thanks to Sharon Carty and Richard Pearson. I hope you have a great tour beginning in February.
Thank you so much.
Die Fledermaus runs from the 1st to the 23rd of February, touring to Tralee, Cork, Kilkenny, Limerick, Galway, Sligo, Letterkenny, Navan, Dundalk and Dunleary. Further details from irishnationalopera.ie. The Booker Prize-winning author of the Regeneration trilogy, which was set during World War I, Pat Barker has recently turned her attention to the Trojan War, rewriting the Iliad from a female perspective. The Voyage Home is the third title in her current trilogy, in which the all-conquering Agamemnon returns to Greece with his spoils, among them the prophetess Cassandra, and his prize, unaware that Cassandra has foretold his doom. Declan Burke has been reading The Voyage Home and he joins us now. Declan, this is the third and final novel in Pat Barker's exploration of the Trojan Wars and her retelling of great ancient accounts such as the Iliad from a female perspective. So The Silence of the Girls and The Women of Troy were the previous two novels. What did they deal with and where are we now?
So The Silence of the Girls was very much set in the time of the Iliad. It was told by a character, largely told by a character called Briseis, who is awarded as a prize, quote unquote, to Achilles, and she becomes pregnant with Achilles' child. In the second novel, then the Women of Troy. Again, we are in the shadow of Troy and various women who have been taken captive by the Greeks while the Greeks wait for a wind to take them back to Greece. Various Trojan women are enslaved and are trying to deal with their, the destruction of the city, the complete destruction of their way of life and their civilization and so forth. With the voyage home, the Greeks finally get that wind they're looking for. And they head for home with, as you say, their spoils, quote unquote, among them Cassandra, who has been awarded to King Agamemnon. And the story is told by a character called Ritsa, who is a fictional character. It's not the first time Pat Barker has used this conceit, but it allows her. She has been appointed as Cassandra's serving woman, or her catch fart, as Ritsa describes herself, apologising for the vulgarity. Ritsa does. So she gets to see, she's there always when Cassandra is at the centre of attention. So she gets to see the great and the good as they go about their business. She herself is a fascinating character. She's a healer by trade. She has already been widowed by the war, and she is effectively a slave, as Cassandra is herself. She's very much a Pat Barker character. She goes all the way back to Pat Barker's earliest novels, which were, you know, set in Yorkshire, but they were very much about working class women who found themselves confined and oppressed by violent, arrogant men. So Ritsa's very much in that kind of vein.
Yeah, she tells it how it is about Cassandra. She's, you know, she's fairly foul-mouthed and she is no fan of this person she's been forced to be.
She's
made to, because Cassandra of course, is the great woman who prophesies what's going to happen.
Well, she does, but as we know, Cassandra famously is fated or cursed to have her prophecies not be believed. But Ritz's experience of her, Ritz doesn't believe in prophecies. She's a down-to-earth, as you say, salt-of-the-earth woman. And her issues with Cassandra are that, you know, when Cassandra goes into her divine frenzies, she, Ritz, is the woman who's left to clean up the mess. And there is physical, you know, she soils herself and she dribbles and so forth. So Ritz doesn't have an awful lot of time for this former priestess who still has, as we would say here in Ireland, notions of herself. That's in the initial stages. As the story proceeds, a bond does develop between the two women, and certainly Ritza comes to admire Cassandra's single-mindedness, because very early on we learn that Cassandra has had this prophecy. She has foretold King Agamemnon's doom. She has seen him lying in a pool of his own blood, and she is determined to do whatever it takes to see that prophecy come true, because as Cassandra says, you cannot cherry pick the prophecies.
So we're on the boat. We have Ritza with Cassandra, and then, of course, Agamemnon comes on board as well, and they're sailing off back to Greece. And Agamemnon Cassandra wouldn't seem like the perfect partner for Agamemnon, but surprise, surprise.
Well, Cassandra is obliged to play a role, Kay. There's no doubt about that. She is effectively a slave, and if she doesn't play this role, then it'll be over the side of the boat she'll go, and no two ways about it. But she is a very clever woman. She's scheming to make sure that this prophecy comes true. So she is going to tell Agamemnon whatever he wants to hear. And in fact, at one point, as we leave behind Troy and head back to Mycenae, there's a very smart thing that Pat Barker does. She basically tells the Odyssey in about two paragraphs, and has, by having Cassandra prophesize what's going to happen to Odysseus and all Agamemnon's former colleagues. So Cassandra's obliged to play this part, as Ritza is herself. And these women cannot be unaware of the seriousness of their situation. If I can give you a quote that Ritza says, she talks about the idea of, you know, Pat Parker doesn't pull any punches. Rape is a weapon of war employed by the Greeks 2,500 years ago. There are many women on the shore, Ritza says, hundreds. Some of those who are holding the girls by the hand will be mourning the loss of their sons. What we were witnessing on that beach, she says, was the deliberate destruction of a people. This is a kind of genocide she's talking. And later, as Agamemnon leads Cassandra into the citadel at Mycenae, what better symbol could there be of Troy's defeat, says Ritza. In war, men carve messages on women's bodies, messages intended to be read by other men. As I say, she's not pulling any punches here. Cassandra and Ritza know that they're in a very, very precarious position. And that's even before they enter the palace where Queen Clytemnestra holds sway.
Now, to get back to Cassandra and the prophecies, she was given this great gift by Apollo. She was a high priestess to Apollo, but she kind of fell out with him.
I would say Apollo fell out with her. So Apollo, yes, he gifted her this the ability to tell the future and so forth. But as always, certainly in the context of this novel, there were strings attached. So Apollo expected a gift in return. And when Cassandra refused his advances, he cursed her. According to Pat Barker, he spat in her mouth, and that prevented, you know, her prophecies from being taken seriously. But there's no doubt she is very much fallen from a height, Cassandra, and that's part of her narrative here, because she has been a priestess, a Trojan priestess of the god Apollo. She has been a virgin priestess and so forth. So this has been a very crude and rude transition for her onto the ship that's heading for Greece.
Yes, and Pat Barker makes great use of, let's say, the locals or the crew on the ship laughing at Cassandra, saying, you know, well, if Agamemnon picked her, you know, he'd want to tie her to the bed, and very dismissive and very crude about her.
It's brutally crude. And again, I've said Pat Barker doesn't pull any punches, and these men are, you know, very, very dismissive. At one point, Ritza has a line about how it's a lack of imagination about especially men, that they would think of captured women as quote-unquote whores when these women have no agency over their own body. And this idea of having no agency over your own body, which is the timeless plight of the slave throughout history, this is very much the situation that these two women find themselves in.
Now, there's another woman, and she's not on the boat, but she's waiting for her husband, Agamemnon, to come back, and this is Clytemnestra. So tell us about Clytemnestra and that very fraught marriage.
Eagerly awaiting the return of her king, but not necessarily for the reasons that Agamemnon might hope. So in a sense, writing from Clytemnestra's perspective, Pat Parker is kind of giving a voice to the voices in the same way she does with Ritza and with Cassandra, because even though Clytemnestra is the queen and she has ruled for 10 years in Agamemnon's absence, historically going back, Clytemnestra had a central role in the Oresteia, the trilogy that depicted the fall of the House of Atreus. But even then, these roles were being interpreted by male writers. This was a very male perspective that was being imposed on someone like Queen Clytemnestra, for example. So she understands the role that she's obliged to play, or supposed to play, I should say. But the reader is made aware very early on that she is, like Cassandra, is planning to see Agamemnon murdered as soon as possible, and preferably by her own hand. Now, this is not something she takes lightly, because not only is Agamemnon the king, and a wildly popular king because he's just defeated the civilization of Troy, this is also something that flies in the face of the will of the gods. She is effectively going up against Olympus in doing this, but that doesn't matter to Clytemnestra. And this is what is so wonderful to me as a reader reading this novel. She is after revenge, pure and simple and hard, because Agamemnon sacrificed their daughter, Iphigenia, in order to secure a wind to get the Greek fleet to Troy in the first place. A decade ago, her anger, her rage...
A 15-year-old child.
A defenceless child who part of the tragedy of Iphigenia's story is that over the course of the 10 years, these stories have grown up about how willingly she went to the sacrifice, and how, you know, in order that the Greeks would, you know, thrive at Troy and so forth. And of course, Clytemnestra was there and was shocked by what, you know, she hadn't expected this and so forth. And she saw this wailing child going towards her father, the priest with the brandished knife, and crying, "Daddy." And oh my God, that part, I can feel it now. It's an incredibly moving scene Pat Barker brings to life.
And does she give Agamemnon any agency in this? Like, is he struggling to make this awful decision? Because his generals are more or less telling him he should do this.
She gives him his agency, there's no doubt about that. He doesn't seem to be hugely morally conflicted about it. You're right. He's getting it from all sides. Okay, the priests, the generals and so forth, we need to get on with it and so forth. If it takes the death of one child, even if it happened to be, blah, blah. I mean, as a person, as a man, as a father, you say, doesn't matter. I don't give it about Troy. This is not going to happen. But look, these are the Greek myths and the Greek tragedies. Agamemnon has much less of a voice than Cassandra and Clytemnestra in this story. And about time, some of us might say.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? You know, because we're talking there about Agamemnon's choice to sacrifice his daughter. And that was to get the ships to Troy to win the Trojan War. And now we've come full circle, as the great Greek writers have. But now Pat Barker is, and we're on our way back.
Yeah, and what we've left behind is a very male world of the Iliad. You know, it's about war, it's about honour, it's about glory. Now, there are female characters in the Iliad, yes, but it reeks of testosterone. When we transition back to Greece, we are transitioning into the world of Greek tragedy. And there we come across some wonderful female characters, Clytemnestra, Antigone, Medea, Electra, etc., etc., and on it goes. Now, again, these were characters who were being written into tragedies by men. What Pat Barker's doing here is giving us Clytemnestra and, to a certain extent, Cassandra, and to a certain extent, Electra, but also bringing Iphigenia back to life. So she's given us those female characters from a female perspective.
And she did a great feat with World War One and her Regeneration trilogy. Has she created something Very important here.
I think so. There's certainly strong parallels to be drawn between the two. And for many of the same reasons, this idea of giving a voice to the voiceless. So it was very much working class men around the kind of famous characters in World War One. So that's exactly what she's doing. I think this trilogy is probably more important in terms of what she's done. That idea of giving voice to the voiceless, particularly these women from 2,500 years ago. But there's that idea of it being a timeless story, these atrocities are still happening today, Kay, and Pat Barker makes that very clear in this novel.
And Declan Burke, thank you very much. And the title of Pat Barker's book is The Voyage Home, and that's published by Hamish Hamilton. It's nice that we're reviewing The Voyage Home in the run-up to the Classics Now Festival, which runs in venues around Dublin from January the 31st to February 2nd. More information from classicsnow.ie. This year's Tradfest celebrates 20 years of bringing live folk and traditional music to venues in Dublin city and surroundings. Following last week's special arena, in which we paid tribute to the festival's patron, the actor Stephen Ray, at the Lark in Balbriggan, next Monday and Tuesday we will team up again with Tradfest to broadcast live from Dublin Castle, bringing you a mix of live music and interviews from some of the festival's headliners. Some of the guests that will be performing at the shows are Irish musician Derry Farrell, Bree Dean, Ono Canavan, Keela and Sharon Ward. And from Guadeloupe, we will have the singer-songwriter Ines Kai, and from Brazil, 353 Samba Club. And a special guest on Monday's show will be Jerry O'Connor, the virtuoso banjo player, who will pay tribute to his fellow banjo player, the founding member of the Dubliners, Barney McKenna. If you would like to join us in Dublin Castle on Monday or Tuesday, the 20th and 21st of January, you will find tickets and details at tradfest.com. And you can, of course, join us live right here on RT Radio 1 at 7 p.m. That's Arena Live from Tradfest at Dublin Castle next Monday and Tuesday. And here's a taste of some of the music that you can expect from Tuesday's Tradfest event. This is Ono Canavan and a song he performed live for us on Arena last year. It's called The Deepest Breath.
Call the hand that once held yours, for old face now forever empty. She was old before she'd lived her youth, hollowed out in a land of plenty. And did you dream last night, child? Did your dream stay with you? Oh, the city sucks the wild from your mind, so hold your dream before it hits you. And where your dreams, they're all that fit you. We dig these graves now every day.
Ono Canavan there, and be sure and try and join us on Monday and Tuesday at Tradfest. Now, that's all for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Damien Chanel was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And the show was produced by Reg Luby. And Fiacro O'Brien is next.